Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and here's a takeaway from a family history that runs deep, a family divide bridged by courage and love.
I didn't suspect that I had white cousins. I knew it.
My ancestors didn't see fit to write down the lives of those people.
Later this hour, two women on the family they knew they had, but the legacy of slavery kept them from meeting face to face. America's divisions and how family can bring them together. Later this hour, we'll talk about family reunions, but we begin with a man who spoke to America nearly a half century ago, his heart heavy with a warning about a divided country and a perilous future.
Whatever the trials and the tests ahead, the ultimate strength of our country and our cause will lie not in powerful weapons or infinite resources or boundless wealth, but will lie in the unity of our people. This, I believe very deeply.
An emotional Lyndon Johnson speaking to the future and telling America that he would not run again for the White House in 1968. The Vietnam War and the divisions in America it had broken open had crushed him as a politician. The positive things he'd accomplished just 4 years before, the giant landslide he won in 1964, all in the past. But history has been kind to LBJ. While he could not see in 1968 the powerful impact of the civil rights legislation he championed in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965, today we can see that impact. America's first African-American president, Barack Obama, addresses the Johnson legacy at this week's LBJ Civil Rights Summit, commemorating the 50th anniversary of President Johnson's signing of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Three former presidents are in attendance at the summit, including Jimmy Carter, who spoke yesterday of all the unfinished business.
We're falling short in a lot of ways. We still have gross disparity between black and white people on employment, the quality of education. A good many of the public schools in the South are still segregated. So there's not any real equality between the two.
President Jimmy Carter speaking at the LBJ Museum this week. Lonnie Bunch is with us. He's the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., and one of the guests at the Civil Rights Summit in Austin, Texas this week. Lonnie Bunch, welcome to The Takeaway.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Lonnie, describe how Lyndon Johnson was able to overcome divisions in the House and Senate to get the Civil Rights Bill passed. But as we look back, and Jimmy Carter notes there, the divisions that exist broadly in America, have been there since the act was signed.
Well, the race has always divided America and divided Congress. What Johnson was able to do was, first of all, he was a Southerner. So he was able to say, listen, I've gone through an experience comparable to many of you and the senators from the South, but time has changed and we've got to change. But in addition to that, because of his acumen as a legislator, he was able to cajole, to prod, to demand, to basically move something through in a way that the Kennedys could not. So Johnson's greatest strength, I think, was his ability to sort of marry a vision, to understand the changes that were going on in the country, and to use that bully pulpit to sort of force legislation through Congress.
You heard that Johnson clip that I played a moment ago of him really just doing that cajoling, that emotional pleading bit for a unified America in the future. It sounds like in 1968 he really didn't believe it, but what's the feeling at the summit about a unified America?
Well, I think the feeling is that as we look back at history, we recognize that that was such a difficult period, and yet we were able to, in many ways, come together, that there were people who provided leadership in the civil rights movement that pushed America, that pushed Johnson. They had a president who was willing to sort of embrace change. And so part of what the message of the conference is that it's a responsibility of all of us individually and collectively to keep prodding, to keep challenging, to make America better, and to recognize that the revolution that was the civil rights movement is still an unfinished revolution.
How shared is this African-American history between the races, and how important is that for you to project and really for the people at this summit to begin to project as we look back 50 years to the passage of the Civil Rights Act?
What was wonderful at the summit and what is really at the heart of creating a national museum is to recognize that the African-American story is not a story for black people. It is the quintessential American story. It is the story that says, here is how America discovered its identity. Here's how America began to live up to its stated ideals. For us at the Smithsonian, what this museum really will do is to help all Americans realize that they are shaped, they are touched, they are informed by the African-American experience historically, today, and tomorrow.
There were voices in 1964 who said this is an overreach, the Civil Rights Act. It's actually unconstitutional in some way. In the Supreme Court decisions and in the reexamination of some of the elements of the civil rights mission, do you see some of those calls for noncompliance, resistance, actually finding sympathetic ears in our time?
Well, I think the challenge for all of us as Americans is to realize that the challenges of the civil rights movement aren't over. And so that as the world changes, as more African Americans have made into the middle class, there's still such a large number of people that are still caught in inner cities with poor health care. So the reality is that even though there will be voices that suggest that we've accomplished all we need to accomplish, the reality is, and that's what history tells us, is that there's still much more to do, and that, like so much in America, there's always going to be this jousting, and that one always has to prod America to help it live up to its stated ideals.
What was the event in the 60s, and maybe the signing of the Civil Rights Act might be one, that really set you on your path of empowerment?
Well, I think I was 2 years old when Emmett Till was killed, and yet as a teenager, I heard that story. As somebody African-American raised in the North who would travel south to visit family, we always heard that what happened to that young Northern teenager. And so for me, I wanted to understand why people hated, why people tried to kill, and that for me, history became a way not only to understand that, but ultimately it became a tool to help America be better, to help America come to grips with the issue that has divided us for a long time, and that is race.
Lonnie Bunch is the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., participating at the Civil Rights Summit in Austin, Texas this week, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act. Lonnie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The morning after the day 50 years ago when the Civil Rights Bill passed the U.S. Senate and was on its way to the president's desk, finally, here was the New York Times headline. Civil Rights Bill passed 73-27. Johnson urges all to comply. Dirksen berates Goldwater. Everett Dirksen was the leader of the Republicans calling for compromise by the GOP, and he was berating Senator Barry Goldwater, a presidential candidate, for saying that the Civil Rights Act was unconstitutional, suggesting that people not comply. Other headlines in the Times that day, U.S. stressing it would fight to defend Asia. Commitment to Laos and South Vietnam called unlimited. There's a lovely historical footnote. In 1964, Jill Abramson was a young footnote, nowhere near the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. She would become a Times reporter during the Reagan years. She became executive editor of the Times in 2011 in the middle of the Obama era. Abramson says today she sees very little resembling the rough and tumble but fair fight openness of the Johnson 60s or the Reagan 80s. The political messages are slicker these days, she says, and the walls restricting press access to the centers of power are higher and thicker than ever.
The Obama years are benchmark for a new level of secrecy and control. And in one way that I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about, because it's, you know, created quite a challenging atmosphere for the New York Times and some of the best reporters in my newsroom who cover national security issues in Washington, and that is the profusion under President Obama of these criminal leak investigations. There have been seven of them, and one of them right now threatens my colleague James Risen, who's been subpoenaed in one of these cases. And collectively, they have really, I think, put a chill on reporting about national security issues in Washington. My colleagues who are still there tell me that the atmosphere has never been more difficult to get information, that sources who want to come forward with important stories that they feel the public needs to know are just scared to death that they're going to be prosecuted, and reporters fear that they will find themselves subpoenaed in this atmosphere.
Your reporter Scott Shane talks about this. How close do you think, and he's characterized some of this, he describes it as a real problem. People are deterred by the threat of leak prosecutions. How close are we to declaring the leak prosecution approach of the Obama administration in terms of dealing with sources as a prior restraint, a restriction on free speech and freedom of the press?
You know, as you know, John, because of a landmark Supreme Court ruling, there is no prior restraint in our country. And we also have never had an Official Secrets Act. But using a very obscure provision of a 1917 Espionage Act that was never intended to touch journalists, the Obama Justice Department is pursuing these cases. And I think in a backdoor way, using, as I said, an obscure provision of an old law, they are tiptoeing close to things that here in the United States we've never had.
In the Reagan years, the White House would go over the heads of the White House press corps and message directly and provide access to reporters from local stations in local markets. Has the Obama administration taken this a step further, going over readers and going directly to people on the Internet to direct their messages?
Yes. And I have to say, I do not begrudge them that. The rise of social media has been a very potent force in our society, and I think the president and the White House would be silly, actually, not to be availing themselves of that channel of communications. To rely on it and completely shut out the press corps, though, I think is an ill-advised approach. And I don't think we're at that point yet. But the amount of friction and confrontation involved in just going about what I see as perfectly normal coverage that in the past wouldn't have even provoked a discussion becomes, you know, a protracted and somewhat exhausting process.
Does dealing with Washington become reminiscent of dealing with Beijing in terms of control of the message, control of information?
No, I think, you know, John, you will have fun making that analogy. But as the executive editor of the Times dealing with the government of China right now, where nytimes.com, our website, and a Chinese website that we launched 2 years ago. Both of those are completely blocked and censored. I would not make that comparison myself.
Jill Abramson, executive editor of the New York Times, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And now a tale of two cities, Boston and New York, two port cities, two cities that helped found this nation, rivals in everything from baseball as the Boston Red Sox take the field against the New York Yankees tonight, to who's got the tallest buildings, who's got the best orchestra. And one more thing. Doug Most is the author of the new book, The Race Underground, which looks at the incredible rivalry between Boston and New York that spurred this country's first subway systems. He's also deputy managing editor at the Boston Globe. Doug Most from WGBH in Boston, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So the subways, I mean, as I get on the 2 train in New York and look at the red, I can see Red Sox, right?
Yes, it's true. You know, these cities have a long history together. We tend to think of them as being baseball rivals and perhaps football rivals as well, if you want to think of the Patriots and Giants. But their history goes much deeper than that.
And let's talk a little bit about, I mean, deeper, quite literally. What were the challenges and the pressures to be first in creating an urban railway system?
Gosh, you know, I think the biggest challenge is something that we all take for granted today, which is simply going underground. We all walk downstairs today when we go to a subway. We walk down those stairs. We stare at our smartphones. We stare at our newspapers. We're oblivious to where we're going. It's as if we're just going to a basement. But centuries ago, that was not the case. People were terrified of the underground and of going down there. That was where Lucifer lived. That was where the devil was and vermin and other things. And the idea of going underground was actually the biggest hurdle for man to overcome to embrace the idea of underground travel.
Convincing people to go underground, about the same as convincing people to get in a metal tube and go you know, into the air for flight. These were technological hurdles that even consumers had to make.
Yeah, it's very true. You know, when London built the first tunnel for transportation in the mid-19th century, on the day they opened that tunnel, they sort of opened it up to, you know, the city, and thousands of Londoners poured down the streets into this tunnel. They got down to the bottom of the step. Half of them kept on walking right through that tunnel to experience the wonder of this engineering marvel. Thousands of others got to the bottom step, took one look down that tunnel, turned right around and went right back up to the surface.
Exactly. And of course, the Bostonians looked at the folks in London and said, we can do this. The New Yorkers were a little more standoffish.
Yeah, so both cities sort of recognized that eventually something had to change. The immigrants had flooded into this country by the thousands in the second half of the 19th century, and the cities were just so overcrowded that there was no place to move. New York, everybody was living in New York essentially in the Canal Street and Lower Manhattan area, and the upper West Side and upper parts of Manhattan were, for the most part, abandoned and desolate until finally, transit operations started to move faster and move quicker and started to expand people further north. But eventually what needed to happen was people needed to move underground. And both Boston and New York eventually came around to that idea. Boston just moved a little quicker than New York.
And, you know, it's intriguing that, you know, in the case of Boston and New York, money was available and it was privately funded and, you know, very different from London. That's something maybe about the Victorian confidence of London in the 19th century and the British Empire.
Right.
They really dug a deep tunnel. I mean, both Boston and New York pretty much put a roof over a ditch.
For the most part, certainly the case in Boston. In Boston, they did what was called the cut and cover method, which is essentially exactly what it sounds like. You cut a trench in the road, you lay down the tracks, and you cover it over. That's essentially what Boston did. New York did that for the most part. However, there are some, anyone who's familiar with the New York subway system, of course, knows there are certain parts of the New York subway where you are very deep underground. For example, up in the 180s, up in Washington Heights, there are certain subway stations where you take an elevator down to the tracks.
Hey, I know about elevators there, Doug. I use a wheelchair. I mean, I live for subway elevators, believe me.
So, yeah, so those and that particular area of New York was very, very dangerous building it. There was a huge, huge accident that happened around 1902, 1903 when they were digging down there. They were using dynamite really for the first time in underground tunneling. And there was a horrible, horrible accident where they did some explosions and the workers went back underground, and then an enormous boulder collapsed on them and a dozens of workers died in this explosion. So this was still very rudimentary and very sort of the early days of tunnel digging, and they were learning the hard way, unfortunately.
And who won? I mean, if you ride the subway system, and was this a battle of the moneyed interests of Boston versus New York, and somebody did win at some point? I mean, today, if we look back, can we say somebody won?
Well, certainly Boston got there first, but there's no question that New York expanded much more. Boston got there first by about 7 years, and it's fair to say that when Boston opened, New Yorkers were not thrilled by it. And you could almost sense that New Yorkers were galled by the fact that this little podunk town to the north, Boston, had sort of beaten them to this great achievement in engineering. And I think that was sort of interesting that these two cities, even to this day, there's sort of a friendly sort of rivalry between them, I guess you could say.
And we can take a train from Fenway Park all the way down the Amtrak line to Yankee Stadium.
That's right. That's right. The Amtrak and the trains now sort of you can really zip very quickly now on the Acela, you know, in about 3 hours you can be between one city and the other.
And you want to call the game tonight?
You know, as we've given the Yankees their center fielder. So I still feel good about the Sox this year.
I'm about to say Podunk Town to the north if you don't watch it.
You know, they can have them.
Doug Most, it's a great story and it's a great read, and we can experience it on each of the systems in Boston and New York even today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Doug Most is the author of The Race Underground, Boston, New York, and the Incredible Rivalry That Built America's First Subway. He's also a deputy managing editor of the Boston Globe. Later in the hour, when history comes calling, family history.
My name is Alina, and I'm calling from Seattle. I met my mother for the first time when I was 19. I was one when she'd last seen me. I didn't warn her. I just hitchhiked to San Diego and knocked on her door. It totally transformed my life. And it explained some of the issues I had with my dad. The absolute best thing I've ever done for myself.
Later this hour, an amazing family reunion story. But coming up, some signs of Boston and New York on the same page. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Call us or follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Boston and New York are very much together regarding something in the news today. A big headline in the Boston Globe and the New York Times is a Times story about Russia's secretive behavior in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombing a year ago. The Russians told the FBI that bomber Tamerlane Tsarnaev, who was killed while running from police, was a strong believer in Islam and radical Islam, who appeared to have been transformed in 2010, according to Russian investigators. But what Russian authorities did not share with U.S. investigators until after the bombing was a telephone intercept in which Tsarnaev actually discussed jihad, holy war, with his mother. Michael Schmidt from our partner, The New York Times, joins us now. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What can we say about this piece of information and how it might have changed the way in which investigators in Boston and New York and in the federal government might have dealt with Tsarnaev in the United States prior to the bombing?
Well, there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking here. This is an inspector general's report that's coming out about how the FBI and the intelligence community handled the information it had about the suspects in the two or three years leading up to when the incident occurred. And what they're basically saying here is that the Russians had more information than that they had initially provided to the U.S. in 2011. But what happened was is that after the U.S. investigated that information back then, they didn't find anything to substantiate it. So they went back to the Russians and they said, hey, do you have anything else? And the Russians never got back to them. It was only after the bombing that the Russians said, hey, this is the other information we had. Now, something to keep in mind here is that at the time, the U.S. thought that this was a Russia problem, and Russia thought it was a Russia problem. They were afraid of him going to Russia to cause problems. So, it's really unclear who the onus was on. I mean, it certainly wasn't on the U.S. at that point. They didn't think.
One of the interesting things from at least the reports that we're getting about the Inspector General's report, which will eventually be made public, is that, you know, U.S. investigators were unable to really link Tsarnaev to any specific jihadist group or specific act of terrorism, modality, weapons, those kinds of things.
Correct. What happened was the U.S. did what's called an assessment, which is the FBI has three levels of investigation, and the lowest level is an assessment. They went out, they talked to his members of his family, they looked at some of his computers, some of his public online postings. They talked to some people at his university, and they didn't really find anything that was curious to them. And they basically sort of, after doing a several-week investigation like this, said, okay, we can't find anything. Let's go back to the Russians and see what else they may have. Why is it? What is it specifically that led them to believe that he may have jihadist tendencies? And the U.S. FBI agents based in Moscow went back to the Russians at least twice and said, hey, what else do you have? And they never got back to them.
Any investigators, any sources you may have talked to suggest that this piece of information would have changed their behavior?
Well, what it would have done is it would have probably put a little more scrutiny on them. which means maybe the FBI could have done, instead of the lowest level investigation of him, they could have done a secondary level investigation with him, which would be called a preliminary investigation. So and under the guidelines that the Justice Department has for preliminary investigations, you can do surveillance and more invasive things like that. Now, would they have surveilled him based on that information? It's really hard to say. The answer is probably not. But he would have been looked at a little bit differently, and perhaps when he left the country in 2012 to go to Dagestan and then returned, perhaps the U.S. would have tried to talk to him again at that point.
Could anything have prevented the Boston bombing, a year old on April 15th? Michael Schmidt is a reporter for our partner from the New York Times. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Now a possible food crisis looming. Did you know there is a shortage of limes in world markets? Also pork and avocados. Margaritas are up $1 in some cities. Alaska Airlines had to cut limes altogether from their drink menu. Are there alternatives to these essential ingredients to deal with summer's approaching demands for guacamole, the BLT, the pulled pork sandwich? For help, we turn to Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast. Hey, Dan.
Hey, John.
So this winter really was awful. But to contemplate going through the summer without limes or bacon or avocados, what do we do about this? And why is there this shortage?
Well, it looks like the avocado shortage is largely because Chipotle said it in their annual report. They said, oh, we forecast we may have issues to our business because of global warming and it could drive the avocados. And so that sort of set off a panic.
Word of mouth.
That's right. The limes relates to the Mexican drug cartels, you know, that old chestnut.
Of course it does.
And the bacon relates to an illness that is spreading among young pigs.
Now, periodically, there are shortages of all kinds of commodities, and it's important to come up with alternatives. In the case of the limes and the drug cartels, that one I'm not really following.
Yeah, the lime situation does partly relate to bad winter weather, but it also relates to issues with the drug cartels who have moved into the lucrative lime market and are pushing up the prices, which begs the question, do you still call them drug cartels?
I'll have a lime with my blank. There you go. All right. So what do we do? There's no real alternative to limes.
Well, I think of these three foods, lime may be the easiest to replace.
Very happy news.
I mean, the obvious thing, I'm sure people will think of lemons, which is too sweet, too different of a flavor.
Too different.
I would suggest trying grapefruit. You'll get a nice tart there. Last year at Guactacular, I tried a guacamole that was made with white grapefruit instead of lime, and it was outstanding.
That's amazing.
It was outstanding.
I wouldn't think you'd get that oily, fabulous lime quality, though, with grapefruit.
You probably don't. And I think, look, in general, anytime you're trying to substitute one food for another, you're probably going to be giving something up. So we're already in sort of a depraved post-apocalyptic situation here, John. We have no avocados, limes, or bacon.
Oh, let's talk about the avocados. What's the replacement there? Crisco with food coloring?
This one is the toughest one of all, actually, because avocados have just such a special and unique flavor and texture and mouthfeel. I think that, first of all, you got to give up any hope of substituting the flavor because you're not going to get something that's going to taste like an avocado.
No.
The best you can hope for is to get something that is rich and creamy and fatty in the way that avocado is. Cook's Thesaurus says you can substitute like mashed peas or asparagus or broccoli.
No.
I'm very skeptical. No. I mean, you could take almost anything that you can kind of puree, and maybe if you added some fat, like maybe a soy nut butter or an almond butter that would have nuttiness as well as fat, you might get there. Maybe a white bean puree. Beans can have a creaminess to them. You're getting close. But, I mean, with Cinco de Mayo around the bend, this is we're really sweating down to the wire here.
All right, which brings us to bacon. There's no substitute for bacon.
Well, that is where I will respectfully disagree, John. I'm going to make some enemies here because I'm going to go ahead and say it. I think bacon is overrated. It's delicious. I'm not saying it's not very delicious, but it's not the best pork product, and it is mostly just a delivery system for primarily smoke and salt.
All right, but you're just rationalizing that we can do without bacon. The harder question is, what's the replacement?
If you break it down to its component parts, it's mostly smoke and salt. Other smoky, salty, crunchy foods
are? I mean, do you have to go lamb here? Do you have to go basically with another meat that can easily be in short supply? And it's pretty expensive.
I mean, I think that the reason why turkey and chicken bacon aren't as good is that they're low in fat. Beef or lamb could be a better option. But I think that if you were to take a potato chip and get enough smoke and salt into it and throw it into a BLT and make it a PLT, it would be delicious. That dish will come closer to a BLT than any imitation of the avocado will come to real avocado.
That I will agree with you on.
All right.
Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast.
Thanks, John.
Guacamole.
A story now about the power of family and history and the divides in both of those. Tess Taylor is white. She's a poet from California who writes a lot about family. Here's an excerpt. Off a dirt road, in iron light, in the mountain graveyard, her clan settler stones grow up with moss, thick as the harmonies in shape note tune. Among mushrooms, ivy, rhododendron are tracings, the shadowy foundations of the cabin where she persevered and died. Tess Taylor has been searching for her roots for much of her adult life. So has Richmond, Virginia writer Gail Jessup White, who is older than Tess Taylor, and Gail White is black. Tess goes back to Thomas Jefferson's great-great-grandson, a man named Moncure Robinson Taylor. His brother is the great-great-grandfather of Tess. Gail goes back to the 1800s, when Moncure had a relationship with one of the family's slaves, and Eva Robinson Taylor came into the world, Gail's grandmother. Tess Taylor and Gail Jessup White shared their past and their infectious enthusiasm about the present and the power of family reunion they have discovered together.
I was really excited to meet Tess. I wanted to know if her family looked like mine, if her father looked like my father, for example. My father had a very distinctive look. He was tall. He had red hair. He had high cheekbones. He had freckles. He had that Jeffersonian nose, which sort of has a protruding bridge, which we've agreed is attractive on men, not so on women. So Tess and I are glad we don't have that nose. So I wanted her to help me unravel the secrets of my family.
Did you have any, Tess?
I guess for me, when you grow up with this history of slavery in your family, one of the things that you may think about, whether it's subliminally or openly, is that, you know, given the culture of the South in the past, it's highly probable that you have cousins and family that you will never know about. And, you know, the Randolph Jefferson family has made a very big project over many generations of writing itself down deliberately, of crafting these very elaborate written genealogies. And so I've been haunted for a long time by the sense that those genealogies, while elaborate, are also incomplete. So when Gail contacted me with a reference to a very specific ancestor, John Charles Randolph Taylor, who is my ancestor, and she had done this work tracing herself and her family back to a certain household, I was really intrigued and actually delighted. And it sort of felt like a sense of relief, like, oh my goodness, I'm going to get to meet this person that I suspected existed, but, you know, never knew I was going to meet.
And then you did.
We did. And here's the difference in our experiences. I didn't suspect that I had white cousins. I knew it. What's different is when you get a chance to meet that white relative. And in addition to that, when that person is receptive, as was the case with Tess, to meeting, because some white families are uncomfortable with it. In my own family, it was very difficult and painful for my father to talk about his mother's birth. He didn't know much about her. She died when he was 5 years old, but he always assumed that she had been compromised in some way, that it had been non-consensual sex. I have since come to believe, having experienced this research with the help of Cinder Stanton, who was with the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, that it was not just sex, that she was not compromised, that she was not raped, but that, in fact, she had a love relationship with one Moncure Robinson Taylor that lasted for 20 years. And there's lots of circumstantial evidence to indicate that that was the case. So that's really part of what the discovery has been in this process, to hear how Tess feels about it as a person who comes from a different race, from a different part of the country. There's a generational difference between us. I hate to admit this, but Tess is 20 years younger than I am. So we're learning from each other. This is a learning process for us, and one that we would like to share with other people.
It's really interesting because Gail is looking for traces of a family that wasn't written down because my ancestors didn't see fit to write down the lives of those people. And for me, my parents are both historians, and the fact that that kind of historical inequity sends its roots into the present is just something really painful. It's not something that you can erase, you know, by willing it away. Those records are radically incomplete. So I just wanted to say what happened was, I've written a book of poems about this, and Gail contacted me through a note in Publishers Weekly, and I looked her up, and we started talking, and the cool thing was we seemed to like each other and to get along. And, you know, now it's been, what, a year of conversations?
Just about a year, yep.
So, and I think we've, now this is our third meeting.
That's right. I told Tess I see more of her than I see of my son, my sisters.
Yeah.
And it is a beautiful thing, actually. It is this exchange we have, this getting to know each other, this sharing our history, our shared history, crossing racial lines to be as open and as honest as we can under the circumstances. I think that I hold back a little bit. But that would happen naturally with a new relationship anyway. And that's what we're working through.
You've said that part of what this relationship means is an affirmation that you can be free of the sense that, and this is no justification for slavery, but that all the relationships that took place during slavery were not brutal and vicious, that the creation of life out of that horrible period in American history also included love. It included people who really related to each other, who cared for each other, who regarded each other, and that somehow that needs to get recognized without, you know, justifying a period that we all want to forget.
Well, I try to look at this, that period, because I love history. So I try to look at it with some dispassion, which is really hard. There's no one here now to blame for what happened, for an old and painful and horrible American history. I'm not angry about that history. I want to admire Jefferson for the foundation he set for this country. On the other hand, he was a slave owner. He was a hypocrite. Tess has written in one of her poems, it's one of my favorites, "Oh, Jefferson, you hypocrite." I'm paraphrasing, but...
"You make me tired. Like Whitman, you contradict yourself."
I love that. So I have to work through that as I think about my own family's history and how I feel about American history.
History is heavy. Even for a young poet like yourself, out in California, as far away from all this slavery business as you can get. But there it is, coming home to roost.
Yeah, this has been a really interesting journey. I did grow up in California. I went to Berkeley High. I didn't think very much about this Jefferson connection. It was sort of something my grandfather was into. And I think when the Hemings news got broken in the late 90s, I was writing a paper about how Wall Street had conveniently forgotten the African burial ground. And I was struck with this incredible sense of the irony that I had somehow, you know, at 22 years old, managed never to think about the history of slavery in my family. And I was really struck by how little I knew about that institution as it had been practiced in my family from 1670 to the Civil War. And I really wanted to learn more. So when I got my, you know, land legs as a journalist, I went off and wrote some proposals and spent some time at Monticello working with Cinder Stanton and some of the top historians and archaeologists who are working to reconstruct that history. And what really hit me about it was how partial it is, how much more we are learning and how much more we're learning to name and claim, but how imperfect the records are of what actually happened.
I've got a weird question for both.
Oh, boy.
You know, you're different because of an accident of timing and an accident of DNA on some level. You've come together in this interesting moment and interesting relationship and experience and exploration of history. If you could trade places on some level, what is it about Tess that you would most want to have experienced in your life that you haven't? And what is it about Gail, Tess, that you would have wanted to experience that you never had in your life?
That is a really interesting question.
It is good, and I can answer that.
Are you going to go?
I can answer
that
because I've actually thought about this. Tess has a fearlessness. To me, she can take risks that when I was 35 years old, 36 years old, I was unwilling to take. Tess is recently back from India with her two-year-old. I would never have taken my two-year-old to India because I would have been afraid that something was going to happen to him, to us, to me. And I think some of that has to do with, quite frankly, the freedom, the privilege that comes with being white. As a black middle-class person, I felt a bit inhibited. I always thought that the plane would fall out of the sky, or the ship would sink, or something was going to happen that wouldn't allow me to have a comfortable life. I was seeking comfort and afraid to take risks. And I think that's part of the black experience, the African-American experience. And that's one thing I'd like to have that Tess has.
You can see it in her?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Tess?
Well, I admire a lot about you.
Let's hear that.
Okay.
I like that.
I think Gail has enormous sensitivity. I see her, she's incredibly diplomatic, but also really kind of saying, look, I see it this way. This is my perspective as a black person. This is my perspective from where I come from. I want to help you complete the story. You know, as a white person, you have the option to just kind of forget, not know, tune out. And I think that that happens at the micro level in so many different ways. It's actually hard for me to be even begin to bring them up. When you ask me, what do you think I miss? I'm sure I'm missing things all the time.
And that's the thing. When you're black, you don't miss it. You're always aware. Race is always there. It is always a presence. When I walk out the door, I am very aware of what I look like. I'm aware of how people are going to perceive me. I'm careful about how I present myself. I always want to put my best foot forward all the time.
And that's a good thing. But do you ever wish to yourself, hey, could we just pause the sensitivity, have to think about this every single day thing?
Yeah. Of course. Wouldn't life be so much easier? I mean, I don't want to have to be aware of that all the time. I feel anxiety for my son that I've probably passed some of this on to him because I have this extraordinary son. He's a senior at MIT. He's about to graduate. He's a nice kid. He's smart. He's thoughtful. He holds doors open for people. He loves his mother. He's about 6'1", broad-shouldered, beautiful, rich-colored skin. And when people see my son, I know they stereotype him. So every day, I'm worried that something horrible is going to happen to my son because some wicked person has stereotyped him. And I use that word deliberately, wicked. And no mother should have to endure that, but African-American mothers do every day. And I don't think Tess has that experience.
To both of you, and to wind up here, you seem to have a kind of sisterly bond. What do you think that sisterly bond says about America today, about race today, about what we should aspire to in this country in terms of our interactions?
Well, I think sisterly bond is pretty strong. I have two sisters, so I know what that bond feels like. But I do think that we have an opportunity and are developing a bond and a good relationship, and a relationship that is allowing us to be as open and as free as we possibly can under the circumstances.
Tess?
I feel like we have a good bond, and I feel that this conversation is great because we're enjoying having it, partly because of what we're saying, and partly because I think it feels joyful to believe that it's a possible conversation. The content of the conversation is interesting, rich, but there's also in me a sense of, hey, we can do this. We can talk. We can learn about each other. We can like each other. And that feels joyful to me. So thank you, Gail.
Yeah.
Tess Taylor is the author of a collection of poetry, The Forage House. And Gail Jessup White is a communications consultant who lives in Richmond, Virginia. They are related through the Thomas Jefferson family line. Those two women remind us every family has a history, every family is a piece of our larger history. Here's one of your stories from Dearborn, Michigan. In 1992, at age 25, married with three children, I met my half-brother for the first time, even though I'd known him for most of my life. Only as a neighborhood boy who my father took pity on and would occasionally pay to help cut our lawn and work in the gardens and such. I was devastated for months at learning this. I also felt sad for my half-brother because he didn't get to have our father all to himself. Like I did. Nothing more to say there, but lots more to say tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.